Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 1, through to chapter 21 and verse 9.
When the Lord your God has cut off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you have dispossessed them and settled in their towns and in their houses, you shall set apart three cities in the land that the Lord your God has given you to possess. You shall calculate the distances and divide into three regions the land that the Lord your God gives you as possession, so that any homicide may flee to one of them. Now, this is the case of a homicide who might flee and live there. That is, someone who has killed another person unintentionally, when the two have not been at enmity before. Suppose someone goes into the forest with another to cut wood, and when one of them swings the axe to cut down the tree, the head slips from the handle and strikes the other person, who then dies. The killer may flee to one of those cities and live. But if the distance is too great, and the avenger in blood, in hot anger, might pursue and overtake and put the killer to death, although a death sentence was not deserved, since the two of them have not been at enmity before. Therefore I command you, you shall set apart three cities. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he swore to your ancestors, and he will give you all the land that he promised your ancestors to give you, provided you diligently observe this entire commandment that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God and walking always in his ways. Then you shall add three more cities to these three, so that the blood of an innocent person may not be shed in the land that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, thereby bringing blood guilt upon you. But if someone at enmity with another lies in wait and attacks and takes the life of that person and flees into one of these cities, then the elders of the killer's city shall send to have the culprit taken from there and handed over to the avenger of blood to be put to death. Show no pity. You shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, so that it may go well with you. You must not move your neighbour's boundary marker, set up by former generations, on the property that will be allotted to you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. A single witness shall not suffice to convict a person of any crime or wrongdoing in connection with any offence that may be committed. Only on the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a charge be sustained. If a malicious witness comes forward to accuse somebody of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in the office those days, and the judges shall make a thorough inquiry. If the witness is a false witness, having testified falsely against another, then you shall do to the false witness just as the false witness has meant to do to the other. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. The rest shall hear and be afraid, and a crime such as this shall never again be committed among you. Show no pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. But when you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots, an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you. He brought you out from the land of Egypt. Before you engage in battle, the priest shall come and speak to the troops and say to them, "Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near to do battle against your enemies. Do not lose heart, or be afraid, or panic, or be in dread of them. For it is the Lord your God who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you victory." Then the officials shall address the troops, saying, "Has anyone built a new house but not dedicated it? He should go back to the house, or he may die in battle and another dedicate it. Has anyone planted a vineyard but not yet enjoyed its fruit? He should go back to his house, or he might die in battle and another enjoy its fruit. Has anyone become engaged to a woman, but not yet married? He should go back to his house, or he might die in battle and another marry her. The officials shall continue to address the troops, saying, Is anyone afraid or disheartened? He should go back to his house, or he may cause the hearts of his comrades to melt like his own. When the officials have finished dressing the troops, then the commanders shall take charge of them. When you draw near to a town to fight against it, offer it terms of peace. If it accepts your terms of peace and surrenders to you, then all the people in it shall serve you at forced labour. If it does not submit to you peacefully, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. You may, however, take as your booty the women, the children, livestock, and everything else in the town as its spoil. You may enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall treat all the towns that are very far from you, which are not towns of the nations here. But as for the towns of these people that the Lord is giving you as an inheritance, you must not let anything that breathes remain alive. You shall annihilate them. The Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, just as the Lord your God has commanded, so that they may not teach you to do all their abhorrent things that they do for their gods, and you thus sin against the Lord your God. If you besiege a town for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you must not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. Although you may take food from them, you must not cut them down. Are trees in the field human beings that they should come under siege from you? You may destroy only trees that you know do not produce food. You may cut them down for use in building siege works against the town that makes war against you until it falls. If in the land that the Lord your God has given you to possess, a body is found lying in open country, and it is not known who struck that person down, then your elders and your judges shall come out to measure the distance to the towns that are near the body. The elders of the town nearest the body shall take a heifer that has not yet been worked, one that has not pulled in the yoke. The elders of that town shall bring the heifer down to a wadi with running water, which is neither ploughed nor sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the wadi. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him, and to pronounce blessing in the name of the Lord, and by their decision all cases of dispute and assault shall be settled. All the elders of the town towards the body shall wash their hands over the heifer, whose neck was broken in the wadi, and they shall declare, Our hands did not shed this blood, nor were we witnesses of it. Absolve, O Lord, your people Israel, whom you redeemed. Do not let the guilt of innocent blood remain in the midst of your people Israel. Then you shall be absolved of blood guilt. So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst, because you must do what is right in the sight of the Lord.
There are some big subjects in this passage. Slavery, genocide, cities of refuge. But some of these we've already covered in quite some depth. I'll refer back to them when we go back to them. Some we're going to be covering in more depth later on. But this passage, it's chosen a long section because there's a theme in it that I think we need to pick up on. So I'm going to try and focus on that theme rather than going into too much detail that might distract us from it. Basically, in our passage, we've got two bookends. You can see them for yourself. So in chapter 19... In chapter 19, it starts by opening about the atonement that God doesn't want to hold the people guilty for the blood of an innocent man. That bloodshed has to be atoned for, that they need to purge themselves from the guilt of shedding blood. And then when we get through to chapter 21, the other bookend is that the elders and the judges in the town, they're going to declare that their hands are not guilty of this shed blood. And they're asking God in 21:8 not to hold the people guilty of the blood of an innocent man. And the bloodshed would be atoned for by this strange sacrifice of this bull. And in verse 9 of 21, that in this sacrifice of this young bullock, that you're going to purge yourselves from the guilt of shedding innocent blood. So all this passage from one end to the other is this big focus on the shedding of innocent blood in the land. And what's the problem with shedding blood in the land? There's a major problem. Numbers 35 and verse 33, this is what the words say, this is what God says. Do not pollute the land where you are. Bloodshed pollutes the land. And atonement cannot be made for the land on which blood has been shed except by the blood of the one who shed it. Do not defile the land where you live. It's where I dwell. For I, the Lord your God, dwell amongst the Israelites. This is God's land where God is going to dwell with his people. And if he's surrounded by the constant cries of innocent blood from the land, you remember back to Genesis, how Abel's blood cried out from the land. If this land is contaminated by innocent blood, God cannot dwell there, nor will he allow his people to dwell there. And that is one of the main reasons why the Israelites were sent into exile, why eventually they were cast out of the land. So in Ezekiel 16, in Ezekiel chapter 23, in Ezekiel chapter 36, what God says is this: I poured out my wrath on them, on the Israelites, because they had shed blood in the land. They brought upon themselves God's blood vengeance for the bloods of sacrificed children, for the murders carried out by women, for the blood shed upon the land. And the psalmist, Psalm 106, laments it because he realizes and recognizes this is why the Israelites were driven out, because of this blood shed on the land and the fact that it wasn't atoned for by those that caused this bloodshed. And therefore the land could never be redeemed, just pollution built up and built up until eventually God just says, enough, out of here. Now Moses knew this is going to be a big problem for Israel. He's remarkably foresighted. As you see, as we've gone through Deuteronomy, he can see all the problems coming. This is another one of them. And lo and behold, every time Moses has given a warning, that's exactly what Israel has ended up doing. They've just ended up rebelling and going against God. But anyway, Moses has seen it. He's looked ahead. He knows it's going to be a big problem. And so what he does is he talks about five areas of bloodshed in our passage. So the first one you can see and recognize is in the case of accidental manslaughter. So verses 1 to 10 are talking about those circumstances and what's supposed to happen in those circumstances where somebody has accidentally killed somebody else. And it gives us the picture of this axe coming adrift and accidentally killing someone. Also, within chapter 19, verses 10 to 13, we do have premeditated murder and how that has to be dealt with. When you move into chapter 20, verses 1 to 15, this is looking at war. Just straightforward war and conquering of other lands. And the second half of chapter 20, we have holy war. In the Hebrew, it's haram. And this is the holy war against all the people that lived in Canaanites. The Canaanites and the other tribes that are listed there round about them. The total annihilation of a population. And then the final one in chapter 21, 1 to 9, the final bloodshed on the land, is unsolved murders. Because even though you can't find the perpetrator, something needs to be done about that blood that is shed in the land. And this is it's a founding principle. It goes all the way back to Genesis. So Genesis chapter 9, verse 5, this is what God says, for the life is in the blood. So therefore, for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. Everybody needs to give an accounting for life shed, not only from men, but from animals who shed the blood of humans. For every man, there has to be an accounting for the life for the blood of another. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. So it's an appalling crime against God and against the image of God which is in man, for people to be taking their lives, or for animals to be taking their lives. God will call an account. But what's happened is, and we can see it in our passage even, but what's happened is men have picked up this idea of God's justice as an invite, as license for vengeance and as license for injustice. So if blood has been shed, they want to kill him. No matter what, blood's been shed, we're going to wipe out the perpetrator no matter what. And our passage picks up on it. It's in verse 6 of chapter 19. The reason for setting about and setting aside these cities of refuge is because otherwise, it says in verse 6, the avenger of blood might pursue the accidental killer in a rage and kill him even though he is not deserving death. So this idea that as soon as somebody dies, even if it's by accident, the avenger is going to try to kill them. They're going to chase them, hunt them down, and if they can't escape to the city of refuge quick enough, they're going to take their lives. And God says, it's not justified. This accidental death, blood has been shed, but the killing of the perpetrator is not justified in this circumstance. He is not deserving death. And in fact, it's confirmed in chapter 10, verse 10 of chapter 19. Because what's going to happen is that if the avenger of blood manages to capture the manslayer and kill him, what God says is, you're building these cities of refuge because innocent blood should not be shed in your land. You're building these cities that you, as a nation, will not be guilty of bloodshed. If you don't provide these safe cities and people get murdered in vengeance for manslaughter, then you, as a nation, are guilty for it. So what we can think then is, back in Genesis 9, when God says he demands an accounting from people, what he's not demanding, a life for life. It's not like bookkeeping where you've got an in ledger and an out ledger. The two must always balance. That's not what God is saying. But if you kill somebody or an animal kills somebody, then God is going to question you and he's going to find out exactly what happens. But once he's heard that, then a judgment will be made based on those circumstances. And just because somebody's died doesn't mean more blood should be shed. And you'll see this becomes really obvious in our passage. And in fact, this abuse of this idea caused Jesus, in Matthew 5, you'll remember, to pick up on our passage, Matthew 5, 38 and 39. He picks up on it and he quotes this passage from Deuteronomy. He says, you've heard it said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I tell you, if someone strikes you on your right cheek, turn to him the other cheek also. And so what he's saying is that people have taken this passage in Deuteronomy and they're abusing it. They're using it to justify vengeance and violence and stuff like that. And God says, that's not what it's about. Jesus says, it's not what it's about. The whole point of this passage is that it's about proportionate justice. So it's an eye for an eye. So you don't have to take the eye, but it has to be proportionate. When it comes to a life, you only take a life if a life has been lost. So this idea we had of deporting the breadwinner in a family to Australia for stealing a loaf of bread is well outside of this. That's disproportionate justice. And what's actually happening in our passage is that this passage here, although it's full of what things that we might find objectionable, what's actually happening here is God and Moses, they're promoting proportional, reasoned justice. They're promoting civilized actions, even in warfare. They're working against vendettas and people outputting rage and getting involved in any form of barbarism. These are all things that have been told against in this land because all of those involve even more shedding of blood and that we shouldn't be adding to it. There's some justified killing. So, for example, manslaughter. It's justified because it was accidental and there was no intention, no malice aforethought. And that doesn't justify additional bloodshed. That's what's been said here. What this doesn't mean is it doesn't mean, again, this is in our passage in chapter 19, verses 10 to 13, that doesn't mean that there should be soft justice. Because we made the mistake these days of coming up with soft justice. Because we think it's nice to do the Jesus thing and forgiving everybody and never calling for justice to be done. Again, that's not what Jesus was asking for. He was going against this idea of disproportionate justice. And we can see that this idea of justice being done in 10 to 13, basically what's going to happen is, if a guilty person has murdered somebody and they flee to a city of refuge, then what's going to happen is, after a suitable trial in that city, and if the person is found guilty of murder, then those murderers will be handed over to his pursuer so that the sentence of death can be carried out. Now, this was really radical, because we can read and see reports at the time, pagan temples were absolutely full of untouchable criminals. They'd swear they'd run into these pagan temples, they claimed sanctuary and hidden inside the temples, and they couldn't be taken out. So as long as they managed to get the food, then they were safe in there. It doesn't matter what crimes they'd done, what murders they'd done. But in God's system, no. In a city of refuge, if somebody had fled there and they were guilty, they weren't allowed to just claim sanctuary. They were going to be turned over for justice to be done. But it was to be appropriate justice, eye for eye, life for life. So, for example, in a lot of things, when we talk about eye for eye, you've accidentally put somebody's eye out, even if it's in a violent act, then it doesn't necessarily mean your eye is plucked out, but, as we do in this country, you could pay compensation to make up for the loss of earnings or for the pain inflicted. So those things you could pay compensation, but what it does tell us in the scripture is that when it comes to the loss of a life, there is no compensation. The life has to be taken. You can't just pay money over to get yourself off of a murder. What we see, as I say, is that justice is still central in these circumstances. Say we're looking at bloodshed and how it must be dealt with. But in actual fact, it's interesting that in the land, this is in verses 2 and 3, verse 8 and 9, and verse 14, that in these verses, the whole land is actually framed around justice. So it tells you to measure the distance between the cities and set up the boundaries and the borders to ensure that wherever these cities of refuge are, that everybody can get to them fast enough to claim sanctuary. So the whole system, the whole city is set up that way. And when you extend your territory and you go beyond the boundaries that are here, you've got to add another three cities to make sure that everybody can actually access refuge. It's always readily available. And this is why we get this strange message about these boundary stones never being removed, because the land is based on justice. You move the boundary stones and you might end up forcing somebody outside of their safe zone and denying them access to justice. So once the boundaries are set and the city's in place, there's no moving it. There has to be justice. And what Moses also mentions here at the end of verse 19 is the essential role of two witnesses to ensure that there's a fair trial. And again, this is where the eye for eye, life for life, tooth for tooth comes in. And it's basically talking about these witnesses. So if false witnesses come along and they're lying about what somebody's done and that's discovered, then what those false, whatever punishment that might have been due on the falsely accused now falls on the false witnesses. So if they're accusing somebody of murder, then those false witnesses, when they're discovered, you take their life. You know, if they were going to do something that would cause a loss to them, maybe the equivalent to a loss of an eye, then maybe they can pay compensation. But life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It has to be fair and it has to be just. There's a whole load of wonder about this whole idea of the cities of refuge. And I would love to talk about it now because it's really exciting every time. But I'm afraid if you want to listen about cities of refuge, there's a sermon on Deuteronomy chapter 4, 41 to 43. And that sermon's entitled God Our Refuge. You can go and listen to that online. And that talks much more detail about the cities of refuge and what went on there. It talks about the avenger of blood and the protection of the kinsman redeemer within these cities of refuge. It talks about the cities being a sanctuary while we await the day of judgment. It talks about the release and the absolution of those that have been declared innocent. And what we saw when we looked at that passage, how all of this foreshadows Jesus, who is our refuge and our protector, but also the pursuer and also the judge, but ultimately our redeemer. And that's all linked about the cities of refuge. But I'm not going to talk about that detail here because that's going to distract us. But it's a good sermon. If you've forgotten it or haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. God, our refuge. There's a strange... I won't do that one yet. Chapter 20. We'll move this one. This talks about war. And effectively, what you're going to see is that war is not classed as murder. So when we think about the commandment, do not kill, do not go to war. It means do not murder. Because as you look at chapter 20, you see there's no indication that war is something that needs to be atoned for, or sacrifices to be made for. So the war is separate to murder. But what our passage in chapter 20 is doing is showing that when the Israelites, when God's people do conduct war, then there shouldn't be any barbarism, unlike the other nations round about us. And we can see that straight away, because at the start of chapter 20, Moses introduces this section on warfare with real, civil, compassionate, and sometimes trivial excuses for people to avoid warfare. So it's in verse 5-8. So it says, you know, young men, you do not need to go to war if you've just built a new house. You don't need to go to war if you've planted a vineyard. You don't need to go to war if you've got a gauge. You don't need to go to war if you're frightened. You don't put anybody else off by your fear being contagious. And I think people will be court-martialed for trying to come up with some of those excuses in our Army and Air Force and Navy. But this is how Moses opens up this passage about warfare. And almost to show it has to be civilized. Warfare is ugly. But if you're going to have to engage it, you're going to be civilized about it. That's for your own fighters, and it's for the people that you're fighting against. And there mustn't be any of the bloodlust and the barbarism that seems to be so common in so many places. So when you're going out and you're going out to attack people in verse 10 of chapter 20, it says, when you go out, first of all, offer terms of peace. If you can avoid warfare, do it. Offer terms of peace. You're only to fight if those terms of peace are refused. And then when you do go into fight, you only attack the fighting men. The women and the children remain untouched. Says the end of chapter 20, you don't destroy the crops, you don't cut down the orchards, you don't cut down the trees, only what's necessary, trees necessary for building siege engines, but you don't use fruit trees for that. So there's an element of civility, and you just do not see that in other wars and other warring parties. You can spend any time looking at war throughout the world, and you see there are so many atrocities that happen, partly due to bloodlust in men, and partly because of some human instinct to dehumanize people. They're really dreadful things. But the Israelites are going into this with their eyes open. They're supposed to have this call of letting people off fighting stands before any of the generals get hold of them. You know, everybody saw the fighting men stand before you and say, yeah, go and get married to your wife. Go and sort out take the first fruits from your vineyard. Go and do your house. All of this happens before they're actually enlisted in the army. But it's very different when it comes to Haran, when it comes to holy war. And this is, as you see later on in our passage here. Haran and holy war only applies to the specific Canaanite nations that God has designated. There is no haram against the world in Jewish religion. There's no haram against the other nations. But basically, when it comes to haram, you wipe out everybody. You wipe out the men, you wipe out the women, you wipe out the children. You just purge the whole nation. And none of this is classed as murder or as unacceptable. Now, it's really hard for us to accept when it comes to women and to children. But again, all the ins and outs and the morality of that I covered in another sermon back early in Deuteronomy. This is Deuteronomy 1, verses 19 to chapter 2, 37. And that sermon's entitled Genocide. So if you want to read about the ins and outs of that, go back and listen to that one. But the long and short of it, of that message, is that for Canaan, Haran is the final judgment on a group of nations who for hundreds of years have deliberately rejected God and turned against him and have carried out horrendous evils in the land. To say the sacrifice of children had become a commonplace theme, messing about with demons and idolatry and stuff like that were horrendous, but they're deliberately rejected and gone against God. And so God had said, they need to be wiped out. Every single one, men, women, children. But it's interesting, when you go to Joshua 2, you can read the story of Rahab, in Jericho and that first city when he entered the promised land, she was an indigenous Canaanite. But she wasn't killed. And the reason she wasn't killed is because she believed God and was saved. Anybody who was willing to turn to God from anywhere in Canaan would be relieved. They wouldn't have to face this genocide, as you might call it. And, you know, when you read Joshua chapter 2, you can read Rahab's conversation with the spies who had come into the land. And she said, everybody knows. Everybody fears your God. They know who he is. They know how mighty and how powerful he is. But the sad fact is, the people of Canaan would not bow down to God. They knew who he was, they knew what was coming, but still refused to turn. Only Rahab and her household are saved because they believed God and turned. And this whole idea of wiping out complete civilizations is not unique to Canaan. We've got precedents set with Noah's flood. Only 8 were saved out of the entire world, only Noah's household. And in Sodom and Gomorrah, again, when those fireballs from heaven rained down, everybody was struck down. Even Lot's wife, who turned back and looked, was struck down and turned into a pillar of salt. So this idea of wiping out absolutely everybody is happens in the Bible. But in each of these circumstances, opportunities are given for people to turn. So we read that Noah, he was preaching righteousness, but people would not listen. They would not turn. And then judgment came. We read that righteous Lot was torn apart living in Sodom. But again, the people would not look to his witness. They would not turn to him and be saved. And judgment came. The Canaanites knew and could see what was coming and how powerful and who God was, but they would not turn. They preferred to stick with their evil and following their idols. And what Jesus did is he linked each of these to the final judgment. So, you know, to the leaders in Israel, you know, it's going to be just like it in those last days as it was for Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, for it be in the last days, the people will be eating and drinking and getting married, just like it was in the days before the flood. And so just as there were witnesses, Noah and Lot and the people of Israel, as are witnesses to these people who are about to face judgment, we are called to be his witnesses, Jesus Christ's witnesses in the world, to warn people of an impending judgment. And it will come, and it will be merciless. I think that's the message we can take from that. The long and short, chapter 20, is that Haran, this purging of the Canaanite nation, is not like jihad that you read about coming from Islam. People are not to be viewed as non-human creatures for torture or slaughter or for abuse. They're not to be. And we in the West, under our Christian influence, think, oh, yeah, that's fair and reasonable, and everybody should think that way. But the sad reality is that people don't think that way. As I said earlier, as you look around the world, if you think about Rwanda, we think about the behavior of ISIS, we think about what happened to the Yazidi women, we think about what happened in Rotherham, we think about what happened on October the 7th in Israel, when Hamas came and raided. Torture, slaughter, abuse, violence is a normal part of the world's wars. But this is not supposed to be part of the wars that God's people undertake. Their values and their culture is to be very different. It sounds hard in our ears, but it's supposed to be very different to the rest of the world as it was and as it still is. So come to our last section, nearly there. Unsolved murders. Chapter 21, verses 1 to 9. Innocent blood shed. Now, those unsolved murders in the land of Israel, we know in hindsight, they included children sacrificed on altars to ancient idols. And if we think about innocent bloodshed today, when we're thinking about children are sacrificed through medical intervention, surgical intervention, and abortion to modern idols of career and leisure, self-interest. It's no different. The world hasn't changed. Verse 8 of chapter 1 says, the blood guilt, if it's not dealt with and dealt with justly, the blood guilt falls on the entire nation. The entire nation of Israel was guilty of every murder that happened, every shedding of blood that was not dealt with. So in this passage here, Moses gives details of how to determine who is to deal with this dead body, who's to deal with all the rituals surrounding it. And as we look at this little passage here, there's a number of interesting things we can pick up on. So the first thing is, if we look closely at verses 3 and 4, it's not the priests who are to perform these rituals. It's not the priests who are to perform this sacrifice. It's always and exclusively the priests, but not in this instance. It's to be the elders and to be the judges. We can see in verse 5, the priests are to be in attendance, but they don't do actually any of the ritual. I mean, they're responsible for ensuring justice is done, but the elders and the judges perform all the rites. The second thing to notice is, atonement is not made with a lamb, with its lamb's blood being shed. Nor is it made with a scapegoat. If you remember, the scapegoats were used where the sins of the nation were laid upon it, and then that was carried out in the wilderness. But interestingly, in this circumstances, it's a young work animal. It seems to be just about the only place in scripture that it's referred to, but it's a young work animal. So one that would have been used for ploughing the land or for grinding the corn or whatever it was, one of those, but one that had never worked, that had never put its shoulder to the plough or its shoulder to the ground. And the third unusual thing that was spotted here is that the animal's blood is not to be shed. Unusually, again, one of those few instances, what's supposed to happen is its neck is broken. Now, unfortunately, in the King James Version, they've got a dodgy interpretation. It is dodgy, because the New King James Version, they've shown it. I think in the King James Version, they had the idea is that the neck broken, it's like smashed, and so people think it was like somehow cut off or beheaded or whatever it was. But everybody recognises now, it doesn't actually mean that, but means its neck is broken. So, and that's unusual. Now, the animal is a specific animal. In Hebrew, it's bakar eglah, which basically means a cattle or an ox. It's used for the ploughing or grinding grain. It's to be a young one, so it means less than 3 years old, and one that's never worked. And in Jewish ideas, as soon as an ox puts its shoulders to the plough, somehow it's become corrupted. So it might be picking up on that idea. But anyway, but the idea is that this is a young. It could be a cow, it could be a bull, but life was dedicated to working. So anyway, that's the animal that's chosen. It's interesting that animal is the same one that was used in the ritual by Abraham. When the first promise was first given to Abraham, and you remember there was a covenant where they cut the animals in half? Well, the animal, this bakar eglah, was the first animal to be cut in half when this covenant was set between Abraham and God for this land. So it could be that there's a link to that one. The animal is similar to the red heifer in Numbers 19, but it is different. That one's called Adam Parah rather than Bakar Elgar. And there's also in Numbers 19, it's a very different ritual. So basically the red heifer, its blood is shed, and then its blood and the animal is burnt to ashes, and then the ashes are mixed with water and used for cleansing, specifically for cleansing of the temple and the priests. But this is a different animal. Our animal, its blood is not shed. Now, this is really weird because bloodshed is normally required for atonement. When we get through to the New Testament in the book of Hebrews, we're told there nearly everything requires to be cleansed with blood. Without the shedding of blood, there can be no forgiveness. So, what is this killing? What is the breaking of this animal's neck actually doing for people? Well, it's interesting because again in Hebrews 10 verse 4 we're told that it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. So all of this sacrifice in the Old Testament and the shedding of blood in the Old Testament was symbolic. It could never actually achieve its purpose of wiping sins away. Only the blood of Christ, we're told in Hebrews, could actually do that. So it's all symbolic. So again, there are symbols here. So, and again, you think, well, why break its neck? Because you think about the case of the scapegoat. If you remember that, what happened was there were two goats, one of them gets slaughtered, and the other one, the sins of the people are laid on it, and then it's sent off into the wilderness, and in symbology that it's carrying the people's sins away so that God won't judge them. So it's interesting that, you know, why couldn't a bull just be done that? Send him off into the wilderness. Hopefully he'll survive, or at least he's got a chance there. But breaking the neck kills him, takes him out. Well, it's interesting that breaking the neck, again, there's one other place it happens. This is in Exodus 13, in verses 11 to 15. And what God is doing, he speaks to the people of Israel, and he's making clear to them, and he's setting the rules to them and saying, the firstborn male, every firstborn male belongs to God. And what he's doing is he's linking it back to Egypt. Remember where every firstborn male was taken. But the people of Israel were redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. And so what you could do is, you could, the firstborn males which belonged to God, men and all the animals that came with it, the firstborns belonged to God, but they could be redeemed. They could be replaced by a sacrificial lamb, just like the Jews were at Passover. But the donkey, who's often seen as a stubborn, just like man is stubborn, and is often seen as representative of a man, the donkey is not to be sacrificed in that way. Blood is not to be shed. God isn't going to demand the blood from that first one, nor is he going to demand the blood from the sacrificial lamb. He's happy for its neck to be broken, for its life to be given over to him, but it's not redeemed. There's no bloodshed in that redemption. And again, that just reinforces this idea that all of the Old Testament sacrifices, all this breaking of neck of animals, didn't actually wipe away sins. What it did was God provided it as a means for him to withhold his justice from them for a while. But the sin, the true problem, was not being dealt with. But then what's happening in this scenario, there is a perpetrator and we don't know who he is. He's never repented. But there's going to be a bull that is put in place as a substitute. The innocent blood of the bull must not be shed. But in that, there's no absolution for the guilty party in that sacrifice. There's no blood shed to wipe out him. And the bull's blood is not shed because God doesn't want further blood guilt on the land. That's what it says. It doesn't want any more blood shed than the one that's already there. But what happens is with this bull, the blood guilt that's on the nation is atoned for and it's carried away and it's overlooked. So here's where we close. This unsolved murder, it could never be dealt with until the final judgment day when God calls that man or that woman to give an account for that life that's been taken. And then justice will be done. But what about the land? As I said at the beginning, the land is polluted by the blood shed on it. And it can only be redeemed by the blood of the killer. Once it's polluted, it's ruined. So in this case, Israel is exiled from the land because the blood cannot be atoned for. Too much has been shed and the people have got away with it. And the land is no longer a suitable place for God's people to dwell. And then we come to a really big question. When we think about all the blood, the children that have been shed in the land, the animals have been shed mercilessly in the land, the people that have been killed in the land. But what about the blood of the innocent lamb, the Son of God, that was shed in that land? The Son of God condemned by the leaders of Israel using false witnesses. They'll call in that very action, they've called themselves on themselves the judgment of God. In our passage in 21, what it tells us is, you know, these elders of the town that have to deal with this blood, with this bull, with its neck that's being broken. What they need to do is they need to wash their hands in this flowing river and say, we're innocent of this blood. And you can remember we get that scene and that picture in the last days of Jesus' life of Pilate washing his hands. I'm innocent of this blood. But the blood could never be atoned for. And God will call all to give account. But the land has got to be purged. It's got to be sin-free. It's got to be an uncontaminated inheritance for God's people. For God to come and live in the land, it needs to be free from blood because he's left Israel. That's what happens in that judgment day. God will purge the earth. He will destroy it by fire and he will make it anew. A new heaven and a new earth. But in that destruction, every woman, child, animal will be destroyed absolutely, completely. It has to be. And so we're caught to shout out the warning like Noah and like Lot. There is a way of escape. There's an ark in Noah's day. That ark is Jesus Christ. In him, we can find refuge until that day. We can find sanctuary And he is the judge, and he is our protector, and he is our redeemer. And he will take us through that judgment into glory and into living with God on this earth, this clean earth, in the days ahead. Only the innocent blood of Jesus Christ shed for us can truly bring about the remission of sins. No other way is possible. And we have to let people know. Amen. Amen.